according to you.
Okay. So I would say that perfect is the enemy of good and acceptable. So the whole concept here, it's not about the perfection of each and every element. It's about thinking holistically about the five elements. And what I have said all along is that if you focus on all five of these elements over time, and some of them take place over time, you can't think about this that they all get done in 3 months or 4 months. Each one of these elements evolve over time. But the concept is that all decisions that get made, whether they be strategic decisions or tactical decisions or strategic actions or tactical actions, you use this five element model to help guide that decision making that you make over time. So the power of the model is not in the perfection of each element. The power in the model is around the alignment and execution of all five components. And what I have said publicly is that if you have these five elements pretty well aligned, the probability of a successful outcome, meaning value creation, is much, much higher than if you are missing some or all of these elements.
Okay. It reminds me perhaps the case of having a car that you need to align to have an alignment, even though I guess some of the tires might not be brand new, but somehow for the car to have optimum performance, you need to make the alignment work for the car to do well. This is
the analog I would use would be a race car.
Right. Oh, okay.
Okay, so you know, if you have really good tires, but your engine doesn't produce as much horsepower as someone else's, you're gonna lose the race. If you've got really good tires and your engine produces best of breed horsepower, but you have a lousy driver, you're still probably going to lose. If you've got really good tires, really good engine, and a really good driver, but your pit crew is not very good, you're going to still lose the race. If you've got a really good tires and a really good engine and a really good driver and a really good pit crew, but your financial sponsors can't afford to give you the aforementioned, you're going to lose the race. If you have a good set of tires and you've got a good engine, you've got a good driver, you've got a good pit crew, and you've got financial sponsors behind you, you still may not win the race. But you're going to be most likely in the race, and the probability of winning the race is much higher if the five aforementioned elements are not there.
Well said. Perfect example. Let me move then to the next question. In our discussion, we talk, you talk many times about my management systems. I run a management system. Then you talk about I run a management process. This goes across different discussions that we have. Can you please clarify for me when you say a system or a process? In academia, in my mind, it is the committee, some of the committees that I used to have when I wanted to change the product. It might have been some councils that I had that they allow me to receive feedback. In your world, what is this that can be labeled as a system or as a process? Is there a difference?
Okay. So the system is the way in which I ran the company. Now, what do I mean by that? It's a series of processes. And what do I mean by process? I mean, they're repeatable. So a management system is not an event. It's not a series of tactical things. It is a system because it has inputs. And those inputs can be inputs from customers, inputs from the marketplace, inputs from partners, inputs from the management system, inputs from employees. And that goes into a process where that information is used and collated and synthesized to give you an output. And the output is the accountability of the management team. The output is the results that you achieve. The output is what you report to investors and customers and employees and partners. So that is a process. It's got inputs, it's got a process to manage that, and it's got a series of outputs. And I refer to that as how you manage the company, because at the end of the day, it's what a company is. It's got inputs, it adds value to those inputs and creates an output. And the management system is a series of inputs. It's a series of repeatable processes with a very well-defined set of expectations, of outputs, and it is a system and a series of processes that assign accountability for those outputs and expectations.
So somewhere you say that these are very important processes, but you have to identify the end-to-end processes.
What I've said is that most companies have five or six critical processes that support is the infrastructure to how the company operates. You know, I'll give you an example in my case. So one of them was quote to cash. So in other words, the process that is linked end to end in a company from when you make a proposal to a customer and you quote a price all the way through when you bill for that service and you collect the money. That's what I mean, quote to cash. Really important, because that is the financial infrastructure of the company. And underneath that are a lot of very important sub-processes. Your customer relationship management, your ERP, enterprise resource planning systems, your customer support, your customer satisfaction, and ultimately the collection of the money, which then feeds the company from a performance standpoint, investment standpoint, cash flow standpoint. And in that, there's a five or six key processes within that quote to cash. One of them is customer relationship, the sales management process. Sales management, how you manage the number of opportunities you have, how many you close, you know, all those things. Resource management, how you link that sales forecast to the number of people that you will need to hire and train in order to deliver what it is you have sold. Supply chain, the management of the supply chain to acquire the necessary technology, products, other things that you need to integrate into your services that delivers to your customers. And then the back end, which would be your accounts receivable, your accounts payable, and your whole cash flow management system. Those are the fundamental enterprise processes that need to be integrated and linked across the business to gain the efficiencies that you need to properly run the company.
So, okay, great. And then we talk in the execution chapter, we talk about performance gaps. And I would like to remind you that we said that in performance gaps, there are two actions required. One is I call corrective plan to reduce the gap. And secondly, exploration of new opportunities that might arise during the time when you observe this performance gap.
Well, let me expand on that a little bit. So when you plan a budget or you plan, go back to the management system. So you've got inputs, you've identified what those inputs are, you got a set of processes to run it, and then you've got certain outputs. And one of those outputs is results. So part of the management system is to, on a very frequent basis, I used to do it twice a month, you would monitor the results that you were getting against the plan that you put in place. Mm-hmm. Invariably, there are gaps between what you had planned and what you are getting. I used to label that a performance gap. In other words, you weren't getting what you expected. Sometimes you got more than what you were expecting. Both were performance gaps. One was a negative, one was a positive. Now, part of the management system was to understand that performance gap. And the way we did that was what I would call root cause analysis. What is causing that performance gap, both on the positive side and on the negative side? Once you had a better understanding of the root cause of that performance gap, you could then take action to close that performance gap. If it was a negative performance gap, it may require additional actions. If it was a positive performance gap, it may suggest that you should accelerate what you were doing in that area because you're getting results that were superior to what you had planned. The key is it needs to be fact-based, and that's what the root cause analysis does, is give you a fact-based approach to what is causing that performance gap, and then taking actions, the management team, taking actions to address that performance gap. That was part of the management system.
One thing that you had mentioned in the same chapter is that you need to be careful when you identify some opportunities. You mentioned that I run a different process when during my performance gap analysis, I recognize that it might be an opportunity. And you said this is completely different than the one that I use when I did the performance gap analysis, which was based on some simple metrics. You use simple metrics in your performance. And we talk about balanced scorecard versus your simplicity that includes financial metrics, strategic metrics, and personnel metrics kind of a thing. So I understand the metrics that you use when you do your performance gap analysis, but then I got lost in our discussion when you start saying that I take these opportunities and I run them in a different process.
Okay, so let me explain that. So again, I use an example. Let's say you have a business unit and you have planned that revenue should grow 6%. I'm just making this up, okay? So you've got a business unit and you put a plan together, you have a strategy, you've got the assets that you think are necessary to drive the output, meaning results that you expect, in this case, 6% revenue. So you go through a quarter or two quarters and you say, gee, the business isn't growing. That then is a performance gap, correct? Okay, so then you initiate the root cause analysis. And the root cause analysis suggests that you are missing part of the value proposition to the customer in order to be successful. And let's assume that that gap in the value proposition is you're missing a piece of software, or you're missing a certain skills that are required, certain capabilities. Okay, that would then suggest to me that in order to be successful, I need to consider making acquisitions in adjacent spaces that would fill out that value proposition. If that was the conclusion we came to as a result of the performance gap analysis, I would turn to my M&A group and say, look for companies or look for partnerships that fill out the assets that we need in order to fill out that value proposition. So instead of trying to manage that through the operational management system, I now gave that to our M&A group, which would then look for companies that met the needs that we think we were lacking. And we could conclude maybe to buy a company, maybe we would partner, or maybe we would decide to build that capability ourselves inside. But that is an M&A process as opposed to an operational management process.
And also you had mentioned that you should not be overtaken with the process by itself. So not to over rely on processes. You need to use the processes and your system, but not overly rely.
Again, I will use the example of an automatic pilot on an airplane. Mm-hmm. That the automatic pilot mechanism assists the pilot in flying the airplane, but it by no means is a complete substitute for the skill of the pilot to decide what to do. So you still need the pilot to say, gee, I got to visually see the runway or visually see this in order to successfully land the plan. So the process is a tool or set of tools, but it doesn't ever completely supplant the judgment of the management team in the decision-making process. It is a tool. It is an input that is used in making decisions. But the process itself can't be 100% relied upon to give you the answers that are required to drive value creation. That does require people, does require experience, and it does require judgment. Just as an automatic pilot system in an airplane is not a complete substitute for pilots, otherwise you wouldn't have pilots on the airplane.
Correct. Very good. Let me switch then the topic and let's go to the end of the book, the epilogue or, you know, the conclusions. I think if I took good notes and translated our discussion, in that particular chapter, we need to bring the model together. We need to bring also the environment. And we need to bring together the theme of polarities or differences between theory and practice. I mean, these are the three things.
Let's talk about each one of those for a second. So the way I would tie this book together is that at the end of the day, investors invest in management teams that they believe can create incremental value. So the role of a management team is to produce results that are better than the results you would get if they weren't there. Certain systems produce results without the added value of a management team. And I always used to tell my management team that our job was to create incremental value over and above what the company would generate just by existing. Again, Drexel is going to create value just by virtue of the fact that it exists and it's got momentum and it's got inertia behind it. The question is, can the administrative team and can the academic team create results far superior to what the entity would create if the administrative and academic leadership wasn't there? So that's a very important concept, is that a management team in order to justify its existence has to produce results that are a step function better than the results that that company would get if no one was actively managing it. Okay, that's step one. The model that we have outlined is a set of tools and insights to help management teams create that incremental value over and above what the company would achieve if it was running or flying without a pilot, or it was rudderless. The polarities are the differences between an academic approach to that. So what the consultants would tell you, what other people would tell you about how to create that incremental value versus the intuitive, the emotional, the experiential of the management team. And those polarities between what exists in the ideal world and what exists in the real world is what the management team needs to reconcile and integrate and manage over a long period of time. And that is how that incremental value is created by the management team for the investors who have entrusted their money to the management team.
Yes. And in addition to all these things, in the conclusion, I think you and I agree that we need to bring the topic of the turbulence environment.
Okay, so now superimpose that in the world we were in. I mean, we just announced this morning that gross domestic product in this company dropped 33%
right.
in the second quarter. That is, we've never seen a drop like that in the history of the world since the revolution. We've never seen it. Never saw it in the Great Depression in the 1920s. Never saw it in the panic of the 1890s. Never have seen that type of reduction in output of the world's largest economy. That's what's known as turbulence. So we have hit an air pocket. I'll keep using my airplane analogy here. So we were cruising at 38,000 feet. We hit an air pocket that has now taken us from 33,000 feet to 10,000 feet. That's breathtaking. And that has created enormous turbulence. When you go from 33,000 feet to 10,000 feet, those passengers are going to feel it. And even more important, your margin for error now of hitting the ground is much less. You're at 33,000 feet. You've got 33,000 feet to work with before you auger in the airplane. At 10,000 feet, you don't have the room for error. Therefore, in today's business environment, given what we are living with, the degrees of freedom and the buffer and the degree of space to maneuver has contracted dramatically. And that has put more pressure on CEOs and management teams to adjust to that turbulence. And their margin of error has been reduced dramatically. So again, using the airplane pilot, better figure out what the hell is going to go on now that they've dropped from 33,000 to 10,000 feet. They better figure out pretty quick what the hell they're going to do, because the next 30 seconds, current rate and pace, they're going to hit the planet at 500 miles an hour. Well, the same is true of companies. Now, it's not quite as extreme, and it plays out over a longer period of time, not 10 or 15 seconds. But that turbulence has created an environment that is much more precarious and much more laden with potential dangers than what we were experiencing just 6 or 8 months ago. Now, there's also opportunities to think about within that. But the primary thesis here is that because of what we are living through, and we talked about globalization, we talked about all those things, so I'm not going to repeat that. But that environment has now created a situation where CEOs and management teams have much less margin of error, much less degrees of freedom, and must be very skillful in how they manage their enterprises going forward, or they can run into real problems. Just take what's happening to Drexel. Drexel's degrees of freedoms have been reduced dramatically in the last 8 months. Okay, the university went from flying at 33,000 feet to flying at 10,000 feet. That is creating enormous turbulence. You're feeling it right there in your office. And as are the other academician colleagues of yours. And how the university reacts pretty quickly, not in the next 10 seconds, but it's got to react pretty quickly, or there is a chance that the university will not be able to function the way it has functioned for the last 30 years. And you know who that rests on, that responsibility? It rests on you, it rests on your colleagues, and it rests on your administrative colleagues, John and everyone else. It's a collective effort. So in situations like this, if the pilot, in this case the management, is saying one thing, and the passengers and the ground crew are saying something else, the probability of a crash goes up. On the other hand, if everyone is on the same page and they recognize the threat and put a series of actions in place to work collectively, the chances of crashing then are reduced. And the model that we just outlined is a model to help put a game plan in place that everyone can get behind and create opportunities and the significant reduction of threats and possible bad outcomes.
So if I can take you back to turbulence, we can say that it's the environment that eventually will generate this turbulence within which management needs to perform. And for the recent events, we have three things that we can outline as the changing environment that creates this turbulence. One is the globalization 2.0. Second is the pandemic. And the third is the Anglo-American capitalistic system, which is challenged in terms of its output because some kind of imbalances and inequities. Is this the three items that you think we discuss? Of course, we discuss them in a different part of the book, but are we in an agreement that these are the three things that perhaps we can bring as examples in the concluding chapter?
Yeah, I think, let me expand on that. So I think globalization and everything we talked about, think of that as headwinds that we were all facing, okay? What the pandemic has done has just created a gigantic downdraft that we weren't anticipating. So we had headwinds, now we got a downdraft, okay? And that has made the challenge that much more difficult. In addition, we are seeing some gaps in our social cohesion, and we are seeing a reexamination of what our capitalist system and how we practice. Remember, I have said that we practice in the United States very much a shareholder capitalist model.
Right.
And because of these social cohesion issues, and because the capitalist model as we have practiced it since Reagan and Thatcher, have not produced a broad set of benefits to a broad set of the working population. That has contributed to the social upheaval that we are seeing. And it has also put in motion a series of questions about should that system be rethought or certainly modified. And what's important now is that business leaders, government leaders, leaders in NGOs, leaders across the board in all different segments need to engage in a civil dialogue as to what, if anything, needs to be reevaluated and changed. In short, the model that I'm proposing could be superimposed on these broader issues. Do we as a country have the right strategy? Do we as a country have the assets necessary to support that strategy? I mean, for example, if our strategy is to continue to lead the intellectual capital development worldwide, do we have the assets to do that? Do we have the infrastructure to do that? I would say that's a real question mark right now. Okay. Do we have the financial model to lead the world? I don't know, at $24 trillion in debt and growing, do we really have a financial model that supports the strategy? Do we have a management team? Do we have a president of the United States? Do we have leaders in Congress? Do we have leaders in the Senate? Do we have leaders in business? Do we have leaders in academia that we believe can lead that change? And finally, do we have a culture that will reinforce those changes? And I think based on some of the social incohesion, some of the inequality, some of the racial tensions that we are now flaring up, we could argue that culture needs to be rethought as well. So I'd argue that this model can be applied not only to a business or to a university, but could actually be applied. But what's required is civil discourse based on facts. I mean, one of the biggest problems we have right now in the United States is no one knows what the real facts are. Because we're not debating based on facts. We're not debating based on science anymore. We're debating based on emotional arguments on both sides. Doesn't matter whether you're on the left or the right. The fact is, we don't have a common set of facts within which to evaluate the situation and then determine what, if any, changes need to be made. And that is the challenge of leaders. At a government level, at a private sector level, at a public sector level, at all levels of society, those leaders have a responsibility to help lead a civil discourse on what, if anything, needs to be changed and how to change it. And right now, we are not doing that. And right now, we are floundering. And all you got to do is open the newspaper, turn on the television, listen to the radio. You can do whatever you want to do, but it ain't there.
Mike, thank you very much. So you changed my preface, the introduction, and the conclusion.
Okay.
That's you know, I
can't. It's not dissimilar from what we've been talking about.
No.
What's changed in the 5 months you and I have been talking is we're seeing this, what we've been talking about at an enterprise level.
No, you're absolutely right.
We're now seeing, you're seeing it at the university. When we started talking about this, we didn't see this at the university level. We sure as hell didn't see it at a country level. Well, all of a sudden now, what we have been talking about at an enterprise or a company level is now much more systemic and can be applied to a much broader aperture than what we had started out with. That's what's known as turbulence.
But I can see the application of the five elements framework at the level of a nation, at the level of the entire world.
Yes. You're exactly right.
It's so broad, and it has a lot of explanatory power, or also power for implementation, for execution.
Correct.
So I have to rethink about the last two things. At this time, I don't have anything else for you.
Okay.
Question.
Well, that's good. This is giving us some additional insight. That's why these sessions are so valuable, because you're going back, you're asking questions. But because this has transpired over a 4 or 5 month period of time, we've got more insight than when we started out. And I'm beginning to see, because when I approached this, I didn't think about this so much on a countrywide basis, but I'm beginning to see as this plays out now and what we've seen over the last 3 or 4 months in this country, I'm beginning to see that this model is very applicable to what we are currently not doing.
And it has implications, as we said, both on the corporate world and the non-for-profit world, in addition to the nations, to the planet as a whole. I think it's, I still struggle as to how I can name this five elements framework, because if you know, perhaps you might know, Porter also has a five elements competitive strategy. So somehow, you know, I have.
But this is different than Michael Porter.
Of course. But it would be nice if we given names. I put all the letters together, the acronyms. I try, but I haven't been successful. I'll try again, and perhaps I can have some input from a couple of other individuals as to how we can put it together in a simplistic way. And present it as an approach.
I look at it as, and the way I always thought about this, and this model has for me evolved over time. This is not something I woke up with one day. I mean, I went to graduate school at Drexel. I got pieces of this in my own studies. But what I've learned, it was a model that gave me perspective. It gave me context. Mm-hmm. It gave me the opportunity to integrate a whole set of inputs and variables that if you just looked at as inputs and variables, you walked away not being able to put in perspective, into sharp focus, what it is you needed to do. This model allows you to take very disparate pieces of information and perspectives and bring it into a context that allows you to focus, to be able to see more clearly how you can lead and operate in this environment of turbulence.
Yeah. And the best example for today was the race car, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, it was very to the point, and I think I'm going to use it because it's so tangible and so obvious.
Yeah.
Very good. I don't have any more, but
I want to
proceed next week sometime once again.
When are we going to talk to some editors?
Already I started talking. I have provided two of the chapters. I'm waiting this coming week to see the results. If I'm satisfied, then I will proceed, continue. Now, okay. What I do, Mike, just for your information, I go back, as I mentioned to you, to make sure that all the chapters are moving together. And naturally, I have to revise things. And unfortunately, I revise them substantially, but I need to stop all these revisions. And perhaps I need to stop asking you for more input because you're going to revise everything.
but it's just giving you a deeper context around this model and the applicability of the model.
Absolutely. And actually, your words also are so beautiful when you put them together in writing. They make much more sense on one hand. On the other hand, they flow nicely with the writing. And I appreciate Good. That. So,
again, we don't have to answer every question here. This book doesn't have to answer questions.
Right.
But this book hopefully will pose questions and hopefully will give readers a model, a context within which they can be more effective leaders.
Right.
If we did that, that's a huge benefit.
Contribution.
That's a huge contribution. Correct.
Very good. I hope you
do. All right. We'll talk next Thursday.
Next Thursday. Take care.
All right. Stay out of trouble down there in Philadelphia.
I will.
Berwyn. Hey, is the Berwyn Tavern still there on Lancaster Pike in Berwyn?
Of course. Of
course. Well, you know, when I was a kid, I used to go in there and I'd get hammered quite frequently.
You were in trouble here.
I was always in trouble. I was always in trouble. That was the
one. That's why you got successful. Yeah, that's why.
I don't know about that, but I certainly was in trouble. But Berwyn Tavern was one of my major stops. And I used to, I remember they had this big hoagie. It was called the Berwyn Biggie. And it was, I mean, big. And I used to go drinking and then go in there and have one of these big hoagies to soak up all that alcohol so I could drive home without killing myself or somebody else.
But the area is beautiful. It's a very quiet area. And a lot of houses, a lot of people are moving in this area. And real estate prices have moved up, but especially the school district.
Terdifferent East Town School District is a very, very good school district.
Right, right. And, you know, very quiet, good infrastructure. Hospitals are here, Paoli Hospital that I went for my kidney stone. It was really very nice, very effective kind of,
Good. George, well, stay out of trouble. Don't drink too many pitchers of beer at the Berwyn Tavern.
Only water now. All right.
Yeah. You are boring as hell. You're getting bored.
I know.
All right. Cheers.
Bye.